The Mitchell's Front Page Podcast is brought to you by Geelong Bank. Listen live on 94.7 The Pulse, Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 till 11.
On the line now, the Deputy Leader of the Opposition, Richard Marles. Good morning.
Good morning, Mitchell. How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. How are you holding up in all of this? What's that? Where am I? I'm in the studios.
You are in the studio.
I am, but I've got the whole complex just about to myself. I've just seen someone that shares this building from a rival media organisation dismantle their whole desk and computer and take it out one by one. So I'm guessing they're switching to working from home.
Yes. Well, it's a brave new world for all of us, and we're all experiencing what is possible to be done from home. And if you're like me, you've got kids at home who are starting to get cabin fever, and that presents its own challenges. But I think actually a really good job of the social distancing and what they're meant to do, and that's reflected in the stats which are starting to come through. So fingers crossed, but the people of Geelong, I think, right now are doing a magnificent job.
And we're doing everything on the phone with all our guests, but it's amazing, the online technology. We're sort of being forced to use it more than ever now, and it does seem to be mostly holding up.
Yeah, I think that's right, and who knows what this means in terms of changes in the long term as we get more used to using online technology in this way. Having said that, I think all of us are missing that social engagement that is a part of our lives, which we probably took for granted. And so when this all comes and goes and we're able to resume normal life, I'm sure that people will really relish the opportunity to actually be with their friends in person.
Yeah, it's really interesting. There's different people that are coping in different ways, but there's people I know that are introverted types and they're perfectly happy and just content with the world, and it's the extroverted community that's just struggling a little bit at the moment, I think.
That's a good insight, and that's right. It's an extrovert's problem. But you're right, there are certain people in society for whom this is fine, but it's obviously a challenge for so many. I think the other thing I'd like to say is just how fantastic those in our health sector have been. I mean, it's actually quite brave to be turning up to work and doing everything they need to do at the moment. It's got to be a scary prospect what awaits them, but they're doing it and they're facing it, and you know, they're doing it in the face of everything that they've seen from overseas. And again, fingers crossed, with all the measures that we've now taken, we won't have to experience the worst of what we've seen on our TVs from overseas. But, I take my hat off to everyone who's in the health sector. They are the heroes of this moment.
Well, I think that's what people would like to know. That's sort of the big question. Is the curve actually flattening, or do we actually have to wait a bit longer? Because I'm assuming there's going to be a bit of a delay with the stats, given that it takes time for symptoms to develop, for people to get tested, and for the results to come through.
Yeah, it's a good question, and we do have to wait for a bit more time. What we're seeing in the stats is promising. It probably reflects more than anything else the decision that was taken in relation to the border a few weeks ago, because it does take a couple of weeks for these numbers to come through. But having said that, you know, the efforts that have been made in relation to social distancing are pretty significant. There are various kind of proxies for how we measure the extent of social distancing that has occurred, and by a number of those measures, it's between 80 and 90% of social contact has stopped, and that's the kind of number that modellers have thought needed to be achieved in order to really not just flatten the curve, but actually see the curve go right down. So I'm actually hopeful that where things are at the moment will get us to a point where we get on top of this. And it would appear, and I'm touching wood as I say this, that the number of cases in the community is still relatively low. Like, it's a small proportion of our population who've been infected by this. We can't know that for sure, but that's what the data seems to point to. And if that's right, then hopefully we do get on top of this. But it's, you know, we're not out of the woods yet. It could obviously all still turn bad, which is why it's really important to remain vigilant. But there's a lot of hope in what we're seeing at the moment and in what people are doing. And if we keep vigilant for a little while longer, then, you know, we can be confident that we're going to get on top of this.
We just heard from a very stressed-sounding property manager from West End Real Estate, and I think you came out to their office when we did a broadcast from there. But I wanted to ask you about how this sort of six-month moratorium on rent actually works, and how does it get balanced out between, you know, the landlord potentially paying a mortgage and the tenant that probably doesn't want to rack up a big bill, all that sort of thing. How do we get that right? Because, of course, you don't want to kick people out onto the street. I mean, you can't social distance in the street. So how's it working?
Well, it's a work in progress is the answer to that. That is the honest answer to that question. I mean, the starting point is what you just said at the end, which is that you don't want people out on the street. And so, you know, we've been keen to put forward to the government a notion that there'd be a moratorium on people being evicted during this period of time. So I think we're getting to that point. But, you know, you raise a whole lot of really good questions about if you're paying the rent, that's fine. If you can't pay the rent, what does that then look like after 6 months? And obviously this ultimately ends up back at the banks as well, because mortgages need to be repaid. So that's going to be an ongoing conversation, I think, between those representing the renting community and those representing landlords and the banks. But it's not been fully resolved. It is a work in progress. But the most important thing is to make sure that people aren't being put on the streets right now.
How are the banks going in all of this? Because they got a lot of bad publicity during the Royal Commission. Are they doing the right thing by perhaps looking at things like payment holidays for mortgagees?
Look, again, I think the banks seem to be in the right place, both in terms of how they're business is performing, but also in terms of how they are, the role they're playing within our community. So that's good. I think, though, we've got a long way to go, and that's the point to make here as well. That issue around renters is a good example. There's a lot of those measures at the moment which appear to affect one sector of the society, but are ultimately going to involve the banks as well. So I think there's a lot of work to be done in terms of talking through with the banks, both in terms of managing their own business, which is obviously completely critical to our society, but also managing the role that they play. But look, I guess the short answer right now is that I think the banks are being good citizens.
Should people wear, this is a question from an interested listener, should people actually wear a mask when they go out in public to do things like the grocery shopping, and they wonder, were we told not to use masks because we wanted to keep a reserve for the emergency services workers?
And it's that point which is really what I think ultimately goes to the question of masks, and that's their availability. We've had a shortage of masks, and so we need to be making sure that we've got enough masks available for the people who need them the most, and obviously that's those who work in our health system. So that's the starting point. I mean, there's a lot that's been spoken about masks in terms of their effectiveness or not. And again, I think, you know, we'll see more come to light on that over the next period of time. The Deputy Chief Medical Officer made the point that masks are useful for those who have the disease in terms of not spreading it, and obviously that's an important, most critical in all of this. But I think the fundamental point on the question of masks right now on this day is just that there is a limited number of them, and we've got to make sure that we are prioritising them right. Now, you know, maybe in a few months' time, if there are more masks that are available, and let's see what happens there, because there's a lot of effort being put into getting a number of companies around Australia to repurpose so that they can make masks. But so long as we've got a mask shortage, then there needs to be a priority as to who uses them, and that's got to be those in our health system.
So it's sort of a tragedy of the commons, which you've seen right throughout this, which is that what's best for one person is not necessarily the best for all of society.
Well, this is a moment where we need to be thinking about our community and thinking about our role as members of that community. And so there is a sacrifice which is being asked of everyone, even to the point of staying home and not going about your lives in a normal way, to, you know, kids who are not able to go to school and got to think about those Year 12 students who, you know, how they're feeling in the midst of this year. I mean, there's a lot of anxiety there. So there's sacrifice that's being made by lots and lots of people in lots of different ways, not to mention, you know, small businesses, you know, people involved in a whole lot of businesses that are affected greatly by this. There is sacrifice everywhere. But if you're in doubt as to why the sacrifice is being asked and why the sacrifice is being made, then just, you know, take a look at the nightly news and what's coming out of places like New York and Milan, and the absolute appalling tragedy which is unfolding in those cities, modern first world cities with modern first world health systems like our own, and you realise how easily that could be us and why it's so important that we're taking all the steps right now that we are.
How long are we going to be going through this for? You mentioned sort of the families going stir crazy and people sort of living on top of each other who are used to being out all day, every day. Is it really going to be 6 months, do we think?
It's a really good question. No one honestly knows the answer to that question. The Prime Minister's talked about 6 months. I think that's not a bad place to start, and I think he's right to set it, you know, that far into the distance rather than thinking in a more short-term way. We need to be preparing ourselves for a longer haul here, and if it turns out to be a shorter period of time, well, then that's fantastic. But you know, I think thinking in terms of 6 months is about right. I mean, the factors that are at play here, Mitchell, are we need to understand what happens when, if we do get the numbers right down, what is then the position in terms of easing restrictions in a way which doesn't give rise to it all flaring up again. That's a question which is quite uncertain. We're going to get a little bit more information on that over the coming weeks, because in Wuhan in China, where this all started, I understand that they've had a very strict lockdown, but I understand they are going to start easing restrictions this Wednesday. And so we'll get a sense from them as to whether or not they can go back to a place of normality without the virus starting again. They've had a few weeks now where they've not had a single new case reported, so that's why they feel they can start to. So that's obviously a big question in terms of the ultimate timing of this. The other relates to what our medical scientists are doing and how close we are to some form of treatment or some form of vaccine. Obviously, if something like that were to come to the fore, that changes things dramatically. And, you know, there are hopeful and promising signs, particularly around treatment, but you know, it's a real guessing game as to when any of that becomes effective, which is why I think, you know, we need to be planning for a longer rather than a shorter period of time. The one thing that we really know right now about this virus in terms of stopping people from dying is that if you maintain social distancing, you stop the spread of the disease, and if you stop the spread of the disease, you stop people from dying. And that's what we've got to be doing until we know we can ease that.
In terms of China, can we trust the statistics that come from China when they don't have a free press?
Yeah, it's a really good question too. But it's a bit uncertain. I think we do have a sense in the international health community that when Wuhan is reporting a much number of infections, that there's something in that. You know, that you can look at you can look at the graph that they've produced or the data that they've produced over the last couple of months. And, you know, there was a day where they reported, I think, 14,800 cases in a single day, which was the peak of their infection rate. Now, whether that was a fraction of the real number, who knows? But the point is that you've seen change in what they have reported. And so I think there is some meaning in that. But I guess ultimately the question is it meaningful to look at the experience of Wuhan and Hubei province in terms of thinking about what we do? And in my mind, there obviously is. I mean, this is where it started. We've got a lot of information around the world out of the experience of China, and it's really important that we look not just to there, but to countries like Taiwan and to Japan and to South Korea, Hong Kong, to get a sense of what best practice looks like and how they're managing it, because it's in those places that we're seeing much better results.
The JobKeeper payment, how does it work? Who's eligible? All those sorts of things.
Yeah, so the JobKeeper payment is an important measure and one that we've made clear we'll be supporting when we go back to Parliament on Wednesday. But there are two criteria. There's an employer eligibility and then there is an employee eligibility. So basically the employer eligibility is, in rough terms, you have to have experienced a drop of 30% or more in your revenue compared to a comparable period a year ago. It's a bigger reduction than that if you're talking about a turnover of more than $1 billion. But for most companies, it's have you experienced a 30% drop in your revenue? And then that's what kind of gets you into the frame from the perspective of an employer and from an employee. Have you been employed for more than 12 months, basically? And that could be as a permanent or long-term casual or a part-timer or a full-timer. It can even be sole traders in circumstances, but have you been there for a year? Now, there's some more detail than that, but they're the two essential criteria. Has the employer lost more than 30% of its revenue? And as an employee, have you been there for more than a year? If you're fitting those criteria, well, then you should go and certainly be asking the question. The other point I would that there's a bit of water to go under the bridge on this. There's negotiations which are being undertaken right now between the unions and the government. We've obviously been pressing the government for a greater availability of the JobKeeper allowance. So this will ultimately be determined on Wednesday when it goes through the Parliament. But that's the essence of what is being proposed.
And just last of all, can you maybe let people know in the community what they can do if they're really struggling, whether it be for emergency relief and how they can find that, or even people that are worried about their mental health during this time?
Yeah, again, well, firstly, people should feel free to ring my office. 5221 3033 is the number of my office. We're not doing face-to-face meetings, but we are very much open, and that line is being staffed, and we can point you in the right direction. You can also email me on richard.miles.mp@aph.gov.au. Feed Geelong has an online list of organisations around town that are providing food relief, and so it's worthwhile having a look at that. There is the National Coronavirus Health Information Hotline is probably worth knowing as well. That's 1-800-020-080. I'll do that again, 1-800-020-080. And the Victorian government also is maintaining a coronavirus hotline. I'll give you that. It's 1-800-675-398, 1-800-675-398. If you go to my website or Facebook, you'll get all those numbers as well as other numbers which can help you find what services are available at the moment. But there are lots of organisations which are working really hard in our town today and are putting on a whole lot more services than they normally would, bearing in mind that people are suffering. And if you're out there and in one way or another this is impacting you in a big way and you're not sure what to do, do go and have a look at those numbers or go online, because there are services out there and there are lots of people who are there to help right now.
Thank you for being on the program. Look after yourself, because I know this is taking its toll on politicians as well, and we'll talk to you again hopefully soon.
Thanks, Mitchell.
Thank you very much, Richard Miles, joining us there, keeping us informed about what's happening with the challenges around coronavirus. It's tough times.
The Mitchell's Front Page podcast is brought to you by Geelong Bank. Listen live on 94.7 The Pulse, Mondays and Tuesdays from 9 to 11. Or search for Mitchell's Front Page on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or wherever you get your podcasts.